Welcome to Wormhole Waffles, a Stargate podcast. Welcome to Wormhole Waffles. I'm your host, Chelsea, and with me is my co-host, Arzu.
Hello.
Last week, we talked about Stargate SG-1 Season 5, Episodes 13 and 14, where we met some new SGC recruits, and Teal'c was stuck inside the Stargate. Today, we're going to be talking about Season 5, Episodes 15 and 16, Summit and Last Stand. Summit premiered on March 22, 2002. It was written by Joseph Malozzi and Paul Mully and directed by Martin Wood. Last Stand premiered on March 29, 2002. It was written by Robert C. Cooper and directed by Martin Wood also, who I'm pretty sure makes an appearance as one of the SG members who gets killed in this episode.
Aww.
So we finally get to see a meeting of the System Lords in this two-episode arc. Arzu, would you please summarize these episodes?
So the System Lords are meeting, and they're like, not they, but the Tok'ra are like, it's time to kill them.
Yeah.
So they're like, we might as well kill them all in the same spot. Daniel, you have to wear a tight leather vest now for reasons. And it's essentially a two-episode long arc of Daniel trying to poison the System Lords and having some ethical, moral quandrums about why not, and everybody else gets stuck underground.
Yep, the Tok'ra are having their own problems. And
basically what happens with them.
Yeah. Okay, let's do our quote reveal. Last week I gave you the quote, "Oh, swell, it's kind of like old Mardi Gras here." And your guess was that they've arrived at a big celebration and the locals have told them what's going on. And Jack has decided that it's like a Gould Mardi Gras. And your runner-up choice for speaker was Sam.
Now, let me say, there's what I assumed was happening. And then way over on the other side of the realm of possibility is what actually happened. Like, this is so far away from what actually wound up happening that it's actually a little embarrassing for me.
It's okay. You can't always get it.
It's not my fault that Daniel Jackson has all of a sudden developed a sense of humor.
Hey, he's been
all of a sudden.
I mean, he's always been sassy for one thing. He's always talked back to people in the military. But I feel like he gets even more quippy as the seasons go on because, like, Jack's sense of humor rubs off on him. So I think it's perfectly in line with his character.
Okay. Well, it's like last week where I'm like, in context, I see it now.
Yeah.
But, like, at the time, like, the week before. Mm-hmm.
You always assume that Jack is the only funny one.
I looked ahead for the quote for next week. Like, I think it's Jack. Now I have to rethink that. We'll see how I feel by the end of the episode.
Oh, goodness. I hope you didn't cheat, did you?
I didn't see who it was. I just, while I was taking notes, scrolled to the bottom to look.
So. Okay.
But, like, for the record, if I do get it right, I swear I didn't cheat. Like, I was just looking while I was taking.
Sure.
You guys can't see it if you're listening, but the way our notes are laid out is Chelsea takes notes on the top, and then I take notes, and then it's all the wrap-up notes. So the quote is right under where I take notes. So
yeah,
right,
that's there. Fair. Yeah.
I feel like I'm protesting too much. I swear I didn't look.
I swear I'm not a cheater. Okay, so we open with the scene with Lord Zapakna, a.k.a. Zippy, and he is meeting Osiris for the first time. And Osiris is wearing the same desert chic outfit that he was when he left Earth. So
hasn't found a new spirit Halloween to shop from.
Too concerned with building an army to get a new outfit, but he does later. I'm assuming we're going to continue referring to Osiris as he and Sarah as she.
I guess so. Because Osiris is a he.
But he's in a woman's body now, so.
But we had this conversation.
Yeah.
Where, like, when we're referring to the being of Osiris, using Sarah as a host, but the being is male.
Well, technically, the Gould are genderless, except for the queens.
Oh.
So what that's why I'm wondering. Show?
Now I'm drawing a blank. They call him a he? Yeah.
I don't think we ever hear pronouns. They always just say Osiris.
Hmm. I mean, my personal ease of reference would be she, because that's what I see. Yeah. But boy, does that sound bigoted out of context.
Well, you know, if we think of Osiris as a trans woman, then we should refer to her as a she because she's now in a woman's body.
But that actually does now beg the question, is like the mythology of Osiris that humans adopted, was Osiris only male because the host at the time happened to be male?
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I wonder if Osiris was ever considered, like
Osiris the god?
Uh-huh.
Was ever considered female?
Yeah. Seems like only male.
Let's do male then for Osiris and female for Sarah.
I'm just wondering if that's going to be confusing.
True.
Because, I mean, I guess we could argue that Osiris took over Sarah's body because that was the only person available at the time that the urn was broken. But Osiris has had time to since take another host and has not chosen to. Maybe Osiris likes being in a woman's body now.
But does that change the pronoun?
I mean, if the actual symbiote doesn't have a gender,
then I guess, yeah, she. She for Sarah / Osiris.
Okay.
So can I just say, there's a previously on for the first episode, and they're kind of summarizing all the big points that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And because they come from like a bunch of different episodes, I was sitting there like, I have a history test that I didn't study for. Like, that's what it felt like.
It was the same level of panic.
I know, but it was the same level of panic of like when you get to the text and you're like, didn't study as much as you should have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was reminding us of like 5 past episodes.
It was a lot. Yeah, a lot converges on this episode, which is kind of weird because like both a lot happens and like not a lot happens in this episode. So it's weird that it needed to refer back to that many episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, you know, like the farther we get through the seasons, the more like we have to reference past stuff. So.
But then I wonder how, like, at what point do you just go back to the last relevant mention of something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, fair enough. That was easy.
Okay, so we have Sapakna and Osiris meeting, and Sapakna comments on Osiris being in a woman's body, and she just rolls her eyes, and my comment is, your gender politics bore me.
Because, I mean, like, we just sat here and talked about it for 10 minutes, but, like, we're trying to be considerate, whereas
Sapakna is, like, eyeing her. Yeah, he's, like, eyeing her and, like, telling her she's hot. And she's just, like,
moving. Not like, here for your objectification, zippy.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, he, like, walks around her while he's talking. He, like, comes up behind her and, like, talks right in her ear. And she, like, is, like, obviously repulsed and like steps away, and I'm like, yeah,
honestly,
yeah. I feel that. And so it's in this scene that we hear that the new big bad guy in the shadows, who we haven't actually seen yet but we've heard a lot about, is Anubis. And so this is a Gwold who was powerful about 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so evil that the system lords banished him. And apparently some of them thought that he was dead, but he was not. And he was defeated by Ra about 10,000 years ago. And apparently Yu is the only current system lord who was alive back then, or at least part of the system lords back then.
I forgot about you until I saw him again. And that costume.
Yeah.
It's quite something.
It's the same one that he had before.
I know. I just feel like I didn't properly appreciate the fact that that's what would come out if I put like Chinese man into an AI prompt. And that it is very, which like for the record, I don't condone the use of AI, but like it's so stereotypical that I'm like,
yeah,
this is like, here's like, is this episode problematic? Yes.
At least he's actually Chinese though. It's not like, yes. It feels weirder with Daniel wearing that stuff.
Yes. I will grant you that. I'm just like, on the one hand, I kind of see what they were going for, but on the other hand, I'm like, was this your call to make, showrunners? I don't think it was.
I mean...
Anyway, I just wanted to get that off my chest. We didn't have to linger on it, but especially because we have talked about it before.
They have made a lot of interesting choices with what their gold wear and like with Nirti.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What also, another thing that's potentially problematic is the actor who plays the original Jaren that Daniel is impersonating is not Chinese. He's Japanese. So it's like, oh, okay.
The white people running the show are like, that's the same thing, right?
Yeah, like...
Anyway...
Yeah, so apparently, sometimes within the system lords, they talk about one of them being Supreme System Lord, and sometimes they don't. Like, they didn't talk about that here, but I think Anubis called himself an emperor back when he was powerful 10,000 years ago, and in future episodes, we kind of hear about how Ra was considered Supreme System Lord since Anubis was banished, and then, like, Apophis kind of took over that, but it's kind of like... It's not super talked about, so I don't know how important that distinction is. But there's a lot of shakeup when it comes to the system lords, which we'll probably get back to when we actually meet them. But yeah, time to, well, not yet time to meet Anubis, but we will soon.
Time for Daniel to be useful for a change.
Right. So then we get a scene with the Tok'ra Rinal, who comes to tell SG-1 and Hammond about the system lord meeting that's going to happen. And I noted that Hammond called it the briefing room, because before we were talking about what is that room called that they're always talking in?
Yeah.
And we're like, conference room. Yeah, but so it's called the briefing room.
Given that they're in the military, we probably should have guessed. But
I was like, I don't know if they've actually called it that before.
I don't think so.
I don't know. I mean, I just didn't notice it. But in any case, Rinal comes in and she's like, I have news. And Jack is like, they never just come to hang out. And I'm like, yeah. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. And I feel like the only one who ever wanted to like hang out was Martouf. But that's because he was like trying to get into Sam's pants. So I don't think that counts. And Martouf / Lantash, well, Lantash in particular, makes a comeback in this episode, and I find it problematic. We'll get to that when we get there.
And I agree. But we will, like, we'll talk about that. Like, yeah.
So, Rinal does this mission briefing, and she's like, okay, so the system lords are all going to meet at this summit, and so we want to use the opportunity to kill all of them at once. And I was like, okay, but this completely contradicts what Jacob said in a previous episode, because he said killing so many at once would leave a power vacuum and it'll allow one Guo'ul to become dominant rather than spreading the power more equally amongst a lot of them. So why is that suddenly okay now? Like, it's been the operating code for Tok'ra for 10,000 years to take them on from the sidelines bit by bit, and now all of a sudden they're changing their minds and they want to kill all of them at once. Like,
I don't have the answer for this. This is pure speculation, but do you think maybe it's like they I mean, if this is what happened, they should have said something in the episode. But if they like have a solution lined up
mm-hmm.
now, then they're like, well, now is a good time to take them all out because we can fill that power vacuum with.
Yeah. Some. I mean, she does say that they've developed that symbiote poison and they are planning on using that to finish wiping out what Gould are left after the system lords are gone. But there's just so many holes in that plan because, for one thing, they haven't manufactured the poison yet, but also they haven't figured out how they're going to deploy it, like physically, and they haven't figured out if there's going to be a way to kill only the Gwauld or if they're going to have to also kill the Jaffa, which is a genocide. You know? So, like,
also killing all of the Gwauld is still genocide, even if you don't kill the Jaffa.
True.
Still genocide. They're not great people, but it's still genocide.
But it's like normally the Tok'ra do not do anything without thinking about it from 10 different directions, you know, and having all of the holes filled, you know. So why suddenly is it okay to enact this plan when you don't have it all thought out all the way?
Do you think this is another case of the writers forgot, which seems to happen a lot? I mean, at some point it's just lazy. That they keep forgetting their own internal logic. But it could be that, like, they have the poison, yes, that's going to deal with everything mm-hmm. eventually. Mm-hmm. But, like, that they have some sort of something set up to cover their bases and to kind of keep control until the poison is manufactured.
Yeah.
But then there's two problems with that. One, they should have mentioned it in the episode if that was the case. And two, you don't roll out this plan
mm-hmm.
until you manufacture the poison.
Exactly.
So...
my thought is that it's probably a combination of two things. So one of them being that maybe this summit with the system lords was a last minute thing thrown together and they're just grabbing an opportunity where they see it.
10,000 years, they can't wait like a little longer.
My other thought is that, you know, Jacob has said in the past how they were kind of upset with SG-1 for killing off so many major Gwauld because then it leaves power vacuums. And so it's like, okay, they killed Ra, Apophis, Hathor, Heror, Cronus, Seth, although Seth was on Earth, so it wasn't like he was like out about doing stuff. But having killed so many members of the System Lords, and then we get these new ones that are probably brand new members from the past couple years, that maybe the Tok'ra are like, well, we wouldn't have done it that way, but since the Tari are taking out so many Gould so quickly, we might as well speed up the process.
I guess. But like, again, why are we sitting here trying to rationalize that when this is something that should be presented within the narrative?
Yeah. I don't know.
Makes but no damn sense.
In any case, the in for this summit is that the seven system lords who are meeting are allowed to bring one human slave, and they need somebody who speaks Gwauld, even though I don't think we actually hear any of them speaking Gwauld in the episode.
No, so. They all speak English, which, like, I wonder if if it is all Gwauld and it's just like for our benefit.
Yeah, that's possible.
Because I don't, like, maybe I'm missing it, but I don't think there's any occasion of like any of the quote unquote Gwauld speakers
mm-hmm.
speaking to like any of our non-Gwauld speakers.
You know, there was one line in Gwauld when they get to the ritual, but I think that's the only time.
Our whole plan just fell apart.
So, I don't know. Maybe they just prefer English.
Could be.
Yeah.
But then why does it matter?
Yeah, I know. So, it ends up not being special. It ends up not being important that Daniel can speak Gwauld. But
unless maybe it was like, it is in English, but like just in case they speak Gwauld, they need somebody who can.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And so, Renal is like, pretty please, Daniel, will you go act as a human slave?
I put in my notes once Daniel agrees and he's like changing his clothes. I put Daniel is in a tight leather vest. Is Chelsea okay?
But he's not in a tight leather vest. It's like there's like a leather shoulder piece, but the main part of the torso is fabric.
I know. It just looked like a leather vest for a second. And then I made the note and then it turns out that's not what happened. But like,
I would prefer for his shoulders to not be covered because they're nice shoulders. So.
True.
But we did get some nice arm. I think there were, I think the Morrigan's slave was like kind of dressed like a leather daddy. So
the Morrigan's outfit was gorgeous.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like, she, damn.
Yeah. She looked amazing. But anyway, we get to that point. So Daniel like pretends to go think about it basically, but I'm like, Daniel loves to be self-sacrificing. So like, of course he's going to say yes.
Yeah. This, like, all you had to do was be like, Daniel, they have walls. And he'd be like, what?
Are there things written on the walls?
Why didn't you say so before?
What about rocks with writing? Do they have those?
Careful, it's the family show.
And so everyone's getting ready to go through the Stargate. And we have Lieutenant Elliot is back. And it's really nice until it's not nice anymore. Later.
So I have a question about this.
Okay.
This serum thingy that Daniel takes with him.
Okay.
Where you like poke somebody with it and then you can tell them stuff and they'll believe you.
Yeah.
Maybe they said it and I missed it. Is it like time sensitive? Like you have X amount of time to tell them something? Yeah, it is, right?
No. And that's not the impression that I got.
Okay. Like, I was like, you stab them and you have like 15 seconds to like convey the new reality to them and they'll just go with it.
Well, from what I understood, it was programmed so that whoever was infected with the chemical specifically believed that he was Jaren.
Right. But is so that what the chemical did? Was be like, this man is Jaren?
I think so. I don't think he was necessarily required to say anything specific because I think they would have discussed that.
That's remarkably specific.
Yeah, it is.
That's insanely specific.
It's plot specific is what it is.
This
is
like crazy plot specific.
Yeah. And also, why aren't they using that more?
And like, think of the applications.
I mean, Tok'ra are known for being spies, so maybe that's how they've been operating for 10,000 years, is this specific chemical.
I guess so.
I guess it's working. So they go to the Tok'ra's planet, and Lieutenant Elliot is there with his team. I think it's SG-17, and they're going to get a tour of the base and hear about Tok'ra military strategy. And I was like, is Alduin the Daniel of the Tok'ra? Because he's like preparing a lecture for them.
Does he also talk to Walt?
Maybe. Maybe. But yeah, so then they're discussing the plan with Daniel to go to this conference. And they're like, I think the issue, part of the issue is that they assume that by taking out the system lords that there's only going to be minor Gwold left. But I'm like, I feel like they're forgetting things. They're forgetting, one, that Osiris came back. And like, sure, it takes a little while to gain power, but Osiris has a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. Osiris used to be a system lord. So, like, she knows what's up. And then we also have Nirti out there, who used to be a system lord before she was kicked out. And so, like, okay, she's kind of like hiding in the shadows right now, but she's not dead.
Yeah.
And she also used to be a system lord. So it's like, why are y'all forgetting that there are non-minor Gwold that are still out there who would love to come in and take power?
Because they're stupid.
Yeah. Is it because it's the women Gwold?
Ooh. Again, something where if that's the case, which, like, cool, needs to be examined in the text and not just, like, speculated about on a podcast 20 years after the fact.
Yeah, I don't know.
I honestly, like, the plan makes so little sense in this arc that I swear they just forgot.
I don't know.
Or, like, they're not keeping track of the... They're keeping track of, like, the SG-1 beats, like, the beats as pertain to the four members of SG-1, but they're not keeping track of anything else.
I'm almost wondering if they did it this way specifically so that the plan would have to be changed into deciding not to kill the system lords because it would create a power vacuum. Because they immediately revert back to their previous thinking once they realize that there is a new Gua'uld out there who's really powerful.
But why would they not have prepared for this eventuality?
They didn't think that there was another big player out there. I mean, they didn't know about him.
In 10,000 years, you didn't think.
Yeah. Listen. Arzu is very sassily drinking her water.
I'm just passive-aggressively drinking out of my non-Stanley cup.
Which is very trendy right now when we are recording this.
I know you're listening to Stanley cups. Nobody's used those in months.
That's so passe.
God.
Yeah, so they're like chilling in the Toker base. And there's one scene where like Jack is walking somewhere and he just shoves a random Toker out of his way when he's going through a door. And I'm like, what? That was rude. Okay, Jack, calm down. But yeah, so we find out about how, at least for now, the Tok'ra are not concerned at all by the Jaffa getting killed by their poison plan. And I'm like, yeah, y'all are a bunch of a-holes who want to commit genocide. Who are, like, planning genocide.
First degree genocide.
Yeah.
I guess so. Thing, but
yeah.
I guess genocide in its nature is premeditated, so.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And, then they're also, like, showing their own bias towards symbiotes over hosts when it comes to, like, themselves. Because they initially don't want to kill the... Because some Jaffa come to invade. And they don't want to have to kill themselves in order to kill the Jaffa. And it's like... So, you're willing to commit genocide and you're not willing to self-sacrifice. Okay. All right.
Yep. Well, yeah, because it's not a... I mean, I get why.
Mm-hmm.
But to do it this way... Like, this is not a noble fight to do it this way. But I'm like,
no.
But
if you're being oppressed, no. This is definitely fighting dirty, for sure.
Yeah, but I'm like, but at the same time, like, they're causing misery. So, like, there's no polite way to ask somebody to stop oppressing you.
Yeah.
So it's like, ooh.
I feel like, I mean, they're...
Suddenly it's touchy.
They're obviously justifying it by saying that the Gua'uld are, you know, killing a lot of people themselves, you know, enslaving people all across the galaxy. But it's kind of like one of those things where at what point are you willing to go so far in defeating your enemy that you become your enemy?
Yeah. And like there is no good way to stop. You can't politely ask somebody to stop oppressing you.
Yeah.
And I don't want to suggest that that's what's happening. But at the same time, like, don't lose sight of what it is you are fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like maybe they have.
Yeah. I mean,
especially given how flexible this plan of theirs is. I'm like, what are you really trying to do here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with how they've been fighting for thousands of years, like, on their own, and the Tari are, like, brand new to this, and so the Tari have a better sense of their humanity, well, for one thing, because they're only human and not shared hosts, but just in terms of, like, not immediately going for, you know, genocidal plans in terms of, you know, trying to find ways to kill the Gua'uld specifically and not all of the Jaffa who are with them unless it's absolutely necessary kind of thing. Whereas the Tok'ra are just like shrugging it off like, yeah, it's fine. It's just Jaffa.
Yeah.
You know, and like even in the very first episode where we met the Tok'ra, I think what was it, her name, Yusuf, I think. It was like the High Council lady. Mm-hmm. Would never refer to Teal'c by his name. She just called him the Jaffa. And it's like that
racist.
That is racist. It's so disrespectful. So it's like, I mean, they just have no, and it's like, I feel like part of their strategy should have been getting Jaffa to defect all along, because now we see with this Free Jaffa movement that Teal'c is like trying to help start, that some of the Jaffa are willing to listen and they don't like being oppressed. So the Tok'ra could have had Jaffa on their side for hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know,
go figure. All you had to do was ask.
But they're like classist, I guess, and see the Jaffa as beneath them, and so they're not willing to save them and consider
that go their kind lives. Of into the idea of forgetting what you're fighting for.
Yeah, because they see the Jaffa as, I guess, willing participants in what the Ghoul are doing, but like, no, they're slaves. The Jaffa are slaves, and like, yeah, most of them do genuinely believe that the Ghoul are gods, but that's because that's all they know. If they were told the truth, if they were shown the truth, they, most of them would defect, you know, like,
yeah,
not all of them would necessarily want to serve somebody if they didn't know it was for a just cause, you know, like if they realized what the situation actually was, you know, maybe they changed their minds. And but the Tok'ra don't give them that chance.
Yeah. Emma swore. Stupid Tok'ra. I think you can imagine what I wanted to say instead of stupid. Just they frustrate me.
Yeah. They really frustrate me too.
It's like
they kind of,
this might be a bad comparison, but it's like the kind of people who manage to kick a depressive episode by like taking bubble baths and going for a walk, and they like don't understand why other people can't do that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah,
that's their energy, and it frustrates me.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, and just in general, I feel like they've always had a poor sense of morals, because like we've had multiple instances of them roping SG-1 into some mission without telling them all the information and putting their lives on the line, and they just don't care.
And they also won't share their own trade secrets, like the tech and stuff like that. They just don't share information, but they expect people to just go along with it.
Yep.
The Tok'ra suck. God, the longer they're here, the more they annoy. Are they like going to be here the whole time?
Well, I mean, a lot of them are killed in this episode.
Okay, but like, are they going to keep being here the whole time? It's not enough.
I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for you.
Okay, fine.
But, I mean,
buckle up, Buttercup.
Okay, well, I mean, you have to remember that they started with a limited supply. Like, they had a queen who birthed all of them, and she's no longer around. So, every time a Tok'ra dies, that's it. Like, they're not getting replaced by any additional, you know?
Right.
So their numbers can only dwindle.
Good.
Anywho. Yeah, Jacob is telling Daniel about the chemical that he's going to use to trick you. And he's like, just make sure you don't prick yourself with the needle, because I don't know what'll happen. And I'm like, oh, okay.
So even, like, this Jacob that says it, right?
Yeah.
So even Jacob, who we're supposed to love because he's Sam's dad, can't be trusted.
You know what I find interesting is that this chemical is so advanced and so specific that it will force anyone who's injected with it to specifically to think that Daniel is Jaren, and yet they don't know what will happen if you prick yourself with it.
Maybe he'll think he's Jaren. And he's just not reversible. He's just Jaren forever.
He forgets that he's Daniel Jackson.
Which would make an interesting plot twist.
That would be an interesting plot twist. And like trying to like undo the effects.
And like how much knowledge is still stored in his brain, and I don't know, man. I think he should prick himself.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Another issue that I have with the Tok'ra is that they don't have a good evacuation plan. They have been hiding in caves for thousands of years, and yet they have not figured out a way to safely evacuate their base. I don't get it. Like, the moment you detected a mothership in orbit, you should have had one of your people go activate the Stargate and keep it open, and for the next 38 minutes, be evacuating as many people as possible, you know, before the cargo ships and, you know, gliders come down. And then, because, like, obviously whoever's attacking is going to try to dial in. So if you dial out first, you at least have 38 minutes to get people out of there. So, like, why was that not done? Why are y'all so bad at planning?
Arrogant. They're arrogant is what it is.
I guess so. Okay. So Daniel gets there. And he is able to trick you into thinking that he's Jaren. And so then they go into this main, like, conference room area, I guess, which you had confused ideas about. In your notes, you said you thought it was a sex dungeon.
I just wrote a sex dungeon.
Okay. I mean, with the way that they're dressed,
they're all wearing very kinky leather. And there might have been chains. Maybe I imagined them.
I think maybe the Morgan's dude had some small
chains. And the way the Morgan was touching the dude, I was like,
right? Oh, I mean, they're
like,
definitely.
A dom and her sub. Like, what is going on here? So, sex dungeon.
Yeah.
And I don't say this in a kink-shamey way.
Okay. No.
I read a lot of smut. So I know a sex dungeon when I see one. or a playroom. Or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah.
And that's what was going on here. Mm-hmm. That's canon.
I mean,
it's canon.
They could have been, honestly, like, after the meeting was over.
Maybe that's part of the proceedings. Like, you argue and then you bang it out. I don't know.
That's possible. We never know.
We never got that thing. Far.
Yeah, we didn't see the whole thing.
Daniel interrupted it with his poisons and stuff, and we just never got to the orgy.
Yeah, it's very possible. Okay, so we've got a cast of characters here. We have Bastet, who is also known as Bast, the Egyptian lioness goddess. She was looking pretty good. And then we've got Kali, also known as Kalika, the Hindu goddess of time, doomsday, and death. And the actress is actually Indian.
Yay! She's been here before, hasn't she?
No, this is the first time seeing her.
Just kidding.
No. And then we have Baal, who is the Semitic god of fertility, weather, and war.
Okay.
And then we have the Morrigan, who is an Irish goddess of war and fate.
And also the resident party girl, if you've read A Court of Thorns and Roses.
I know her from the Iron Druid series.
I read that one.
That's pretty good. It's got all kinds of deities in it. But yeah, that was the first place I'd heard of her.
I thought I was mishearing it at first. I'm like, but Moore is from A Court of Thorns and Roses.
And then we have Olokun, who is the Yoruba spirit of water, health, and wealth. And Svarog, who doesn't actually have any lines. I don't think. Well, no, he no, I don't think he does have any lines. But he's the Slavic god of fire and blacksmithing. So essentially the only, well, and then we have you, of course, and his full title is, let's see, I have this written down somewhere. The Jade Emperor, the Exalted Lord Yu Huang Shangti.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, that is pulled from Chinese stories, and he is known sometimes as the first god and sometimes as the, and it's kind of translates to heavenly grandfather. And he is considered benevolent, so not so much as a Guault, but the actual Lord Yu was benevolent.
Oh, well, there we go.
Yeah.
Because as a Guault, he's kind of an asshole.
Yeah. So of these, really, just like for your own knowledge purposes, you and Ball are the only major players here.
Yeah.
The rest of them, we're never going to see again.
Everybody else just kind of there looking good.
Yeah. I feel like they picked them as like how can we get as diverse a cast as possible?
Honestly, seriously.
But I mean, they were all showing up in their best fits. Like, they looked good.
I loved the beadwork on some of the costumes.
Uh-huh. It looks good. And so Osiris eventually makes an appearance, and she had a new outfit. She looked good, too.
Yeah. So, I mean,
they were all in their best fits.
I was literally sitting there going, how do I get that jacket sweater duster thing she was wearing?
Yeah. And yeah, I liked her necklace. All that beading on her necklace was really pretty.
Yeah. There was a lot of really nice beading.
Yeah. So the costume department really worked hard on this episode.
Which I guess makes sense because they were not working hard at all.
A lot of designs are just...
Was the costume department I was complaining about last time?
Yeah. I don't remember.
Like, last week was the training episode, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. That's when I was complaining about the no budget. So I see why now.
Yeah. They're saving up.
Wait until next week and you'll see why.
Yeah. Now I see why. They had to use a lot of money on the costumes this time. But yeah, so Daniel is walking around with you, kind of analyzing all these players. And you is so funny. He's like, do not make me look foolish by allowing yourself to be murdered. I'm like, all right. I'll do my best, sir. And so we kind of are swapping back and forth between Daniel, like, constantly sneaking off during the summit, which I'm like, is you not wondering where you are all the time? But okay. Because he's, like, radioing Jacob with all these updates. And then meantime, we have the other plot where the Tok'ra base is now being bombarded by gliders and cargo ships. And so, like, everyone's dying, basically. Even all of SG-17, except for Lieutenant Elliot, dies. So it's like, well, that's a brand new team. I think this might have been their first mission. And they already did.
Is that No, SG-11 is the one that keeps dying.
Yeah, SG-11 has died like 3 times, I think.
Yeah, okay, so this I keep thinking SG-17, but no.
No. When the room that Lieutenant Elliot is in collapses, he's in the same room as Lantash, who is in a
tank.
What would you call that? Yeah, a tank that's keeping him alive. And so Lantash goes into Lieutenant Elliot, which is mostly just like useful for the fact of helping them get out of there safely, because it doesn't really help either one of them survive necessarily. But I just really dislike what they did with Lantash in this episode, because they made it like Lantash is dying, so he wants to like admit his secret love for Sam. And I'm like, sir,
no,
you do know Sam. Because he's like, you know, Sam, since you were once host of Jolinar, who was my mate, now I love you too. And I'm like, no.
That's not how that works.
No, that's not how that works. Because she was only host of Jolinar for like a few days, for one thing. But also, she, while host of Jolinar, didn't talk to Martu for Lantash. So it wasn't like they were dating or whatever. Like, she didn't meet Lantash until after she was host to Jolinar. Like, after Jolinar was dead.
It just...
And,
they were probably trying for some, like, cathartic romantic moment, but, like...
It didn't work.
It didn't work.
Because, like, there were times when she and Martouf would talk, but, like, I don't mean it for, like, half an hour. Like, it's not like y'all ever, like, dated or anything like that.
Martouf was, like... In my head, we are married.
Right.
But
it's like, Lantash, you don't know anything about Samantha Carter. Like, you literally know nothing about her life or her personality or who she is as a person. So how can you say that you love her? And so it just felt really contrived.
Loves the idea of her. of her as like a symbiotic host for Jolinar, not for anything that makes Sam Sam.
Exactly. And so I just thought that was really gross. And then plus, like, they're trying to push this whole romance thing when Lantash is now in the host body of Lieutenant Elliot, who's like 20. And I'm like, it's kind of creepy also.
It also gives it this weird, like you said it in your notes, this weird unintentional, like, emotional burden thing.
Yes.
Emotional labor. Because taking the Lantash Jolinar out of it for a second. Actually, no, we need to have that in here. But, like, just from Sam's point of view, because Sam is not hosting Jolinar anymore.
No.
So from Sam's point of view, this 20-year-old Lieutenant Elliot, who they just graduated into the SGC program, mm-hmm. and who is now dying for some reason mm-hmm. that I'm going to get into in a second, but he's now dying and his last thing is like, I love you, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like, you should know how Lantash feels. And she's like, yeah, I know. I'm like, you're burdening her not only with this stupid worm's feelings, but also with having to comfort a 20-year-old like this.
Yeah.
That's a lot of emotional, like, labor to ask her to do.
Yeah, like, she's already really concerned about this 20-year-old that she feels responsible for because she helped train him, and she wants to get him out safely. So Lantash is just, like, piling on, and it's like, that's not what she needs to be focusing on right now. She doesn't need to be focused on your weird obsession with her because of Jolinar. Like, she needs to be focusing on getting everybody out alive. So, like, one thing, just stop distracting her. But then also, why are you trying to put her through this emotional labor of, like, essentially losing a lover when she was never your lover? Like, y'all were never a thing. She never had those feelings for you. So why are you trying to impose these romantic feelings on her in your last moments when it's not reciprocated? Like, leave her alone.
I don't know, man. It's weird. I don't like it. I also, on the note of, like, Lantash going into Elliot, I don't understand why it didn't work. Is it because they were both dying?
It's because Elliot's injuries were too severe. He was bleeding internally.
Okay, but like,
so
no, the multivitamin can pull people back from like terminal cancer in its last stages.
Well, I think that's different because, like, internal bleeding is like a lot faster and more serious.
But like, late stage terminal cancer has so damaged you on a cellular level.
Yeah.
That I'm not here to argue which one is, like, worse. I wouldn't wish either on anybody. But,
well, I guess the difference being that even though he was stage 4, he was probably still going to live for a few weeks. And he was weak afterwards. He wasn't, like, immediately jumping up and running around. Whereas with Elliot bleeding out, that's a much faster loss that without Lantash he would have already been dead.
I don't know, man. Seems real convenient.
Yeah, I feel like I wish it had been any other Tok'ra except Lantash, because it didn't need to be Lantash. We didn't need to have this weird romantic
but now subplot. Lantash is dead.
Yeah, thank God.
We don't have to put up with this. So maybe it's a good thing it was Lantash. Because now we don't have to deal with his weird incel ways anymore.
Yeah. I mean, they could have just as easily had it been another Tok'ra. That was guiding them out.
Kill Lantash if it's somebody else.
The fact that they were able to save Lantash in the first place was kind of contrived anyway.
They want to kill him properly.
I don't know. I'm glad we're done with him. It's just exhausting.
Amen.
Yeah. So back in the Gould conference room, Osiris comes in and she sees Daniel and recognizes him but doesn't say anything. And so then now we're like ending this first episode because Osiris knows about Daniel and Elliot becomes a Tok'ra and they're trapped and don't know how to get out. So it's like, oh no. next episode.
Starts on a really clever move from Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel is able to prick Osiris with the chemical. So now she thinks that Daniel is Jaren too. And I'm like, yeah, that was really smart.
Yeah, like for once.
Right?
You did something right.
Although then he can't use the poison to kill everybody because it's Sarah. And like, he doesn't want to kill his ex-girlfriend.
Once again, Daniel Jackson is not thinking with his head brain, but with the other one.
Yeah. You know. But yeah, so then we have Osiris telling all the system lords about who she's there to represent. And I love that when she says Anubis's name, like, everybody reacts and they're all like, wait, what? Like, that's not possible. And like, you in particular is like, he was there when that stuff went down. He's like, oh no, 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 not doing that again. And so now that they know Anubis is back, then Jacob is like, okay, yeah, now we can't kill them because then Anubis would just replace them and it would be one power of a gold, which is a problem.
Feels like something you should have thought of. And even if it's not Anubis, even if it was just somebody else.
Like Nirti.
Like literally anybody. Mm-hmm. Why did you not think of this?
I mean, honestly, Nirti might actually be at this meeting because she has the ability to go invisible. So, like...
Okay, but, like, anybody. It could have been anybody. Like, why didn't you think of this?
Yeah, no, I agree. And it is kind of interesting to see, too, some, like, minor Gwoll trying to make a name for themselves. Like, Sepakna is obviously, like, trying to come up in power and, like, really impress Anubis and, like, basically write his coattails into power. And I'm like, you know, get it. But with the system lords being surprised that Anubis is back, what I don't understand is, like, this isn't the first time that they've had somebody that they banished who ended up coming back, because Osiris and Isis were both banished and put in those Canopic jars and left on Earth, I guess, with the system lords thinking that they would never come back. Oh, and hey, look, Osiris is back. So, like, why are they banishing these bad Gwoll instead of killing them? Like,
because they're stupid,
obviously. Maybe they think it's more symbolic, but like, if you actually don't want them to come back, then you should kill them. Like, it seems so obvious.
Oh, it's like, just kill them. But like, honestly, but, just kill them.
But in any case, Osiris is like, Anubis wants to become a system lord, and to prove his worth as a system lord, he is going to destroy Earth. And the reasoning is so flimsy, because you is like, well, we as a system lords have the alliance, so we can't attack Earth, and we have to enforce that treaty with all the other Gwoll. And Osiris is like, but the Asgard don't know that Anubis exists, and therefore he's exempt from the rule. I'm like, that's not how that works. That's not how that works at all.
Maybe that's how they think it works.
And also what doesn't make sense is, like, they're like, okay, since Anubis is promising to do this for us, we now acknowledge him as a system lord. I'm like, okay, you just inaugurated him into your group. And yet, he's allowed to attack Earth. Like, make that make sense.
None of this makes sense. None of this episode makes sense.
Is it like he doesn't officially become System Lord until after he attacks Earth? You know, like...
I think they tried too hard to politic in this episode and didn't really think it all through, because I just don't know. I don't know.
Because I think the Asgard would be like, well, it doesn't matter if we personally knew about the existence of Anubis. He's still a Gwoll, and he therefore is still supposed to be policed by the System Lords. And you, as the System Lords, know that he exists, and also now know of his intent to destroy Earth. therefore, it's your responsibility to stop him. Like, come on.
They thought they had deniability for a second.
Seriously, I'm like, no. Anyway, then they have their really nasty ritual where apparently it's a thing that they have this vat of what looked like fully mature symbiotes that they all decide to eat.
Why?
I'm assuming it's like a power play kind of thing. Like showing they're powerful enough that they can eat their own kind.
I didn't like it.
Yeah, it was weird. And Daniel was just relieved because that meant that they weren't going to make him a gold. Yeah.
That's okay. Sam's already the resident SG-1 ex-gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think there's a conversation later with Daniel and Jacob when they're talking about how the gold numbers have been declining over the past few years, and so maybe them ritualistically eating symbiotes is a contributor to that decline. I'm like, I don't think so, because like 8 Gwold eating a symbiote either just once or over a few days, that's not enough to
make a noticeable dent.
Yeah. Because there are, like, hundreds if not thousands of new symbiotes being born all the time. And right. The System Lords don't have regular meetings. Like, this summit is unusual. It's probably the first one they've had in a couple years. So, like, I don't think that that's an accurate cause of the decline. I think maybe, you know, SG-1 killing a bunch of the major power players kind of has a trickle-down effect.
I mean, yeah, I feel like them charging it with bombs periodically probably does a lot more than eating a worm once in a while.
Yeah, I think so too. Back in the summit area, Daniel is like, I don't know, he's doing like maid duties or something, refilling water bottles. I don't know.
Maid duties?
He's like doing something with water and cups and stuff.
You went to get more drinks.
And that's what I'm saying. He's refilling the water bottles. And he's talking with Ball's servant, who, and the character's not given a name, so I guess he's not important. But Daniel's like, what do you think about them telling us all of our secrets? And do you think that we're in danger? And all this. I'm like, Daniel, you are giving yourself away.
Like, at some point, like, the initial questions, I was like, okay. And then he's asking me too many questions. I'm like, you need to rein it in.
Mm-hmm.
Too many questions.
Going too far. And sure enough, this guy who wants to be a ghoul himself reports Daniel to you. And I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's what I was wondering about the servant.
Yeah.
Was he was telling Daniel, he's like, if I serve faithfully, I too can become a system lord. And I was like, is this like the intern who wants to be the CEO?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so it's not like System Lord isn't like, there's like a System Lord per group.
I mean, yes. The System Lords are chosen by how much power they hold. So like before, it was like, I mean, even after Ra was killed, it was still like Apophis and Cronus and Nirti and you and Ball probably. And now since a bunch of those have died, now we have Bastet and Olokun.
So it's not necessarily like one lord per group.
No, it's just like based on, it's the most powerful ones basically.
Okay, so I was like, what are the chances, buddy? And even now,
I think it's essentially like you can be invited to become a system lord if you hold enough power and resources to become a dominant player.
Okay. Still slim to no chance of this kid actually getting to do it, but.
Well, but you never know, because then you got like Olokun and the Morgan and all, like, they were never system lords before and they're brand new system lords now because SG-1 keeps killing people, you know? So.
It's a Weasley little kid.
Like, never say never. I was thinking about how young he looks, but he says that he's been serving for 30 years. I'm like, he must be using a sarcophagus. There's no way, because he looks like he's 30 himself.
Yeah.
And so that might be part of why he wants to be a ghoul so bad, because if he's used a sarcophagus multiple times, we know how that corrupts people's minds.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe the most trusted Lotars, you know, get to use a sarcophagus, and that kind of preps them mentally for being a ghoul. And I think they're usually kept around in case something happens to the host of the ghoul, so then they have another, like, host ready.
So I guess it's not that unrealistic.
Like, if something happened to Ball's host, then Ball would go into this guy.
Yeah.
No. But the fact that he thinks that he would enjoy it is like, I don't think you understand what it's actually like to be a host. Although, that makes me wonder, if the Gwold has a host who's willing, does that almost make it more of a symbiotic relationship like the Tok'ra have? I mean, not that...
It could... But because of how they operate, in like the assumption that you would play host to then give your body over to it.
Yeah, they wouldn't control.
Like a symbiotic controlling relationship the way the Tok'ra have. They wouldn't, because that's not how they think it should be done.
Yeah, they would never let the host take control of the body.
Right, nor would the host, I think, want to take control of their body, because they're like, that's not what the deal is.
Yeah. We've kind of been going under the assumption that the host is essentially being psychologically tortured for thousands of years. But if it's a willing host, maybe it doesn't feel torturous. Maybe they are fine with it.
It's just like a blissful nothing.
Maybe it's like watching your favorite TV show.
Maybe.
If they enjoy what's happening.
I mean, listen, as of recording time, I'm currently reading a book series where... Throne of Glass, if you haven't read it, I recommend it. Where at some point there's like these things, these creatures that get implanted in people to like pilot their bodies.
Uh-huh.
And the way that's described is they take over the body and you, the original occupant of the body, are aware of everything that's going on, but can't actually interfere at all. So you're just kind of screaming in there.
Yeah.
Losing all sense of yourself.
Yeah, same thing.
Maybe that's what it's like.
I think normally, yeah. I think it's, you know, it depends on the circumstances, but I think that
case. But here's what I'm wondering, is if you are like this person and you want this and really want to be implanted and you want all of that, and then you are, and at first you're going along with it like, this is great, this is exactly what I wanted, and it's like you said, watching your favorite TV show, and then all of a sudden, it suddenly becomes too much and it suddenly... You're not down with this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's that horrifying turn like?
Right. If you watch one too many murders, and it just kind of gets to you after a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Jacob did mention in this episode that part of the reason why they don't have a problem genociding the Gwold specifically is because... Even with the hosts, if they were able to save them, the hosts have been through the sarcophagus so many times that they would probably not really be themselves anymore anyway.
Right.
And I'm like, but I'm not sure I buy that, because when Apophis died and his host survived for just a little bit, what was like, Apophis was kind of like going in and out of consciousness, and his host was able to wake up. His host was in agony. His host hated it and wanted to die, wanted to pass on to the next plane to be with his family. And
lose all sense of self.
And he had probably been host for thousands of years. So I'm not sure that I believe what Jacob says. Maybe Jacob is just rationalizing in his mind to make it easier to kill the Gwold. Because he's like, oh, yeah, you know, their hosts aren't worth saving anyway. And it's like, well, maybe they are worth saving. Or
unless it's like the other extreme, and it's like they're not worth saving, not because they were playing host to the Gwold, but because like they're in agony. if you take it out, they will be in agony.
Yeah, but then at least they could die on their own terms. Like, die in ownership of their own body again.
But Jacob doesn't care. Because the Tok'ra don't care. Because the Tok'ra suck.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just really frustrating. So then we're, like, going back to the Tok'ra base. And I think everybody was killed except for SG-1. And I'm like, well, that makes me wonder how many Tok'ra are left. Because it looked like there were hundreds of people there. I mean, certainly there are some Tok'ra that are out on missions. But that makes me think that they lost a significant portion of their population.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll get more like concrete information about that soon. But I wouldn't be surprised if their numbers are like down to the dozens.
Good.
Yeah, so basically SG-1 make their way out and they're able to change the broadcast message from stay away to SOS. And so they just have to like wait and hope that Daniel and Jacob are going to be able to save them. And Daniel, meanwhile, concocts this crazy plan to try to take Sarah back with him. And he successfully locks her in the back room of a cargo ship. But then you had just been tipped off by Ball's servant about Daniel's loyalty. And so he comes storming in. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you has been around for like 10,000 years. He's not going down without a fight. Like, he's not going to let you do anything that he doesn't want you to do. He's going to put a stop to this.
But also being around as long as he has, I'm surprised it took, like, this is what it took to clue him into something being up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was, like, chemically altered or whatever, so. But maybe he won't be as susceptible to it next time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so you ruins Daniel's plan and he is not able to grab Sarah. And I think both Osiris and you get stabbed, but spoiler alert, they don't die. We're going to save you. They're fine. They have sarcophagi. It's fine.
They're all good.
Yeah. And so Daniel escapes into an escape pod and Jacob picks him up. And so then they go back to the Tok'ra base. But Zippy, who is in orbit, is able to detect their ship and shoots them down. And I was like, I was thinking to myself, like, as they were like crash landing on the planet, that they really need seatbelts in these cargo ships. And then Daniel made the same joke. And I was like,
you guys are on the same wavelength.
Yeah. And then I was like, man, that Vancouver forest is really getting torn up.
I think they have one field that they're allowed to tear up.
Right.
As needed. And then they put up fake trees and they tear it up again.
Yeah, probably. And so they are able to rescue SG-1. Elliot stays behind. Like, Lantash is like, he's too far gone. I'm not going to be able to save him. So Daniel gives him the poison. And so when they take Lantash, Jaffa take Lantash back to the Stargate, he's going to release the poison and at least take a few dozen Jaffa with him. So rip Lantash.
Rip.
We're not really sad about him, but I am sad about all of this. She's 17 dying. Like, first That's mission.
The pro tip. You want to survive, you have to be part of SG-1.
Right?
That's the only team that's safe. That should be you.
Yeah. In general, I find these episodes fun to watch, but then when you get into the nitty-gritty of, like, the Tok'ra's reasoning for doing things, it gets really frustrating.
Yeah.
One thing I always noticed about this, too, Lord Yu, he was, like, drinking tea quite often during these episodes, and I was like, I don't know, there's something nice about a Gould enjoying the simple pleasure of tea. Because we don't normally see them doing such mundane things.
Yeah, they're usually cackling evilly.
Yeah, they're like doing
or storming things, around or like
making speeches,
an evil scheme.
Yeah. But I'm like, I don't know. It's kind of nice to think about you just like chilling at home, drinking his tea.
You know? Yeah, you know, he's got habits.
I mean, if he's like 10,000 years old, then, you know, he's got his favorite tea. He likes it done a certain way. And you know what?
Get he's it. The one who bothered going out to touch grass.
Right. Because of all the Gwold that we see, because we'll see him in the future, he seems honestly like one of the most reasonable ones. Like, obviously, he's still a villain, but he's like, he seems to have his head on his shoulders and, you know, and like just like be logical and straightforward about things. And he doesn't seem to like care to put on a show. Like yeah. A lot of the other ones try to. Like Ball, we'll see more of. He's like very dynamic and charismatic and doing all these things. And you is just like, sup. Listen. Like, I'm done with your bullshit. Where's my tea? So yeah, I don't mind him. Do we cover all of your thoughts about these episodes?
Yes, we did.
There were some problematic things, like some possibly racist stereotypes and casting.
And emotional labor being put on people.
Yeah, that's not
which, great. Don't think. Which to this, like, as we're speaking, at least people will acknowledge casting and costumes to be problematic, but they won't acknowledge dumping emotional labor on a woman to be problematic. So.
Yeah.
But here
I don't know. Although I think even at the time when watching this as a kid, I think I did not care about Lantash. I was just like, whatever. Like,
it's because you were with it.
Who are you? It was kind of one of those things where when we first met Martouf, I liked him because he was cute. But then, like, as we saw more of him, I got tired of him pretty quick.
But as soon as it's Martouf's personality in somebody yeah. else, suddenly you're like, oh, wait. Gross.
Yeah, I mean, the actor was really cute. He can come back.
As somebody else.
As somebody else, yeah. He doesn't, unfortunately, but I mean, I'd be okay with it if he did. Next week, we will be discussing SG-1 Season 5, Episodes 17 and 18, Failsafe and The Warrior. Arzu, are you ready for your next quote?
Yes, I am.
You know, I'd like to take the opportunity to say that this is a very poorly designed bomb, and we should say something to somebody when we get back.
It's Jack. I know I say that every time, but like, it's got the same energy as in this episode when the Chopper lady came. And he's like, nobody ever comes just to say hi. Like, it's got the same energy as that. So they've got a bomb. They got to explode something on their mission.
Mm-hmm.
But either Daniel or Sam has explained like the risks of using this bomb and what could very likely go wrong. And they're still going to do it. But Jack's like, you know, we should complain. That's what I think it is.
Okay, we will find out next week. That's it for today. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, I can't.
Podcast?
I don't know where that came from. I don't even know what accent that is.
Like Fargo.
Anyway, if you enjoy listening to our podcast, we would love for you to rate us 5 stars wherever you can. If you want to talk to us about Stargate, you can find us on our Twitter and Tumblr page at Wormhole Waffles. And you can find me on Twitter and Tumblr at Chelsea Fairless. Arzu, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Arzu Amin. I'm at arzuamin.bluesky.social. I'm at arzug2 everywhere else. So that's Tumblr, Instagram, and Threads, which I'm trying to get better about using. As a network, we are on Twitter at geeky_waffle. We are The Geeky Waffle on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Tumblr. We are The Geeky Waffle on YouTube. We're at thegeekywaffle.com. And we are on Patreon, patreon.com/thegeekywaffle.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. And we'll see you on the other side of the event horizon.